Accession number 10232, reel number 2.
Mr. Crossland, reel 2.
Yes, well, the usual procedure of transport when you've been on leave was to come back by sea, unless there was some particular urgency, because in the early days it was more expensive to go by air than it was to go by sea. So government was, and government also had a special arrangement with the major sea lines to get a discount. However, your ticket took you either to Singapore or Penang, and as you stopped at Penang first, frequently a messenger would come on board the ship with your posting orders, because if you got off at Singapore and found that your posting was at Penang, you'd taken up a little bit more time unnecessarily. So when I returned on the first occasion of my leave, I came back. My next posting was, I think, in Muar. It was in Muar, Muar in North Johor, and that was a fairly notorious area at the time, and the emergency was still on. It hadn't started receding or drawing to anywhere near a close. Can we stop that just for one sec? Now, I was mistaken. I did not go to Muar when I returned from my first leave. When I returned from my first leave, I was posted, still in uniform branch, to Bukit Matajam, which is in Province Wellesley, which is the land on the mainland side opposite Penang. And Bukit Matajam, where I was a uniform policeman still, had got a particular problem, which is even more difficult now, and that is that it was a crossing point for drug runners, opium smugglers and the like. And it is still at this moment being used as a crossing point, because I was back there a matter of 2 years ago, and I went to the same area and spoke to the police officers there, and they said they were still having a lot of problems. But in Bukit Matajam, we had an emergency situation there. We had a number of terrorists, about 40 in all, in the area. We had a platoon that operated in and around Bukit Matajam. Bukit Matajam, literally translated really, it was Nutmeg Hill, and it was quite a sizable hill, not sizable in breadth, but sizable in height. It was a short, sharp hill. And apart from the normal law-keeping that one had to do, we had no jungle companies or jungle policemen available to us there, and we just doubled ourselves as jungle policemen and as well as ordinary beat policemen or civil policemen. And it was whilst I was out with a group and a police lieutenant who was a European police officer, non-gazetted, looking for some terrorists, that we, in fact, we heard noises in a cave, and these caves were very popular with the terrorists to shelter in, and we got ourselves into position outside the cave, and we called out, as is common when we know that someone is hiding somewhere, you call out for them to surrender. We were very proper about that, unless, of course, you suddenly were face to face with an armed person, and you just don't take a chance. We called out in three languages, four languages. In fact, they were called out in Tamil as well, in Tamil, Malay, Chinese, and English, for them to surrender. And not a sound. We called out three times in all, and then we threw in some grenades to encourage people to come out. Still nobody came out. So we then went into the cave, and there we saw a 22-foot python that had been crawling around. It was a little bit damaged, but not much. Probably a bit dazed. And we cut down a sapling, and we tied the python. We rolled him round the sapling and tied his head and tail, and we brought him down. We brought him into the police compound, and all police compounds in those days were surrounded with barbed wire to prevent the possibility of a sudden rush attack by terrorists, you know, who might come into the town and, as they have done, you know, attack police stations and dispose of the policemen. But to give the policemen more of a chance to protect themselves, they have these. And around the outside of the barbed wire, people, seeing from a distance a pole being carried, whenever bandits were shot or when they're shot particularly, they were always brought down and then they were identified so that we would know which ones had been disposed of.
This is their corpses?
It's the corpses, yeah. We never left them. And even if it had been deep jungle, we'd get them flown up by helicopter. And people thought, seeing a lump of something come down, they thought that we caught a bandit. And, of course, a number of the Chinese in the town there would have friends who were terrorists, but wouldn't admit to it, of course. They want to know whether it was someone they knew. And you could find out from your own detectives, your own Chinese detectives, who mingled in with people, that if someone you couldn't recognize immediately, but the general public had recognized, you'd get it back through one of your own detectives and see who he was. But however, this was no terrorist, this was just a snake. And we brought it back. We could have left it up there, but we just thought it would be something of interest.
You said that there were about 40 gorillas in the Bukit Matajam area.
There were.
It sounds as though you had quite detailed intelligence about who your enemies were.
Oh, yes. The special branch network was really quite good. We also used, I hadn't joined Special Branch by this time, but I was aware of the effect of Special Branch, and the network was extremely good. And you collect information and you piece it together, and every little bit of information you might intercept letters, you might have surrendered guerrillas, as you call them, terrorists, and you might get some information from them. Some of them don't talk, others will talk. Some were paid to talk and were quite happy to, if you call it betray their comrades for cash. But our purpose was to rid the country of the country's inhabitants' enemy and to save it from going into Chinese communist hands.
Would the people operating in Bukit Matajam, the guerrillas operating there, would they be people from the locality or would they be outsiders?
Some from the locality. We had a new village there. Now, a new village is, as I explained earlier, when we move people from the area outside of Kuala Lumpur, where I was in the police depot. If we found that a group of Chinese who'd formed a group, probably through farming or for whatever purpose, in an area, and it was easily accessible to the terrorists, then it was a government policy to remove them from that area, provide them still, and they could return to that area to work, but to put them in a living area surrounded by barbed wire and protected by police constables in a little fort with a gate that closed at night, which meant that the terrorists should not be able to get at them or make contact with them. As it happened, they frequently did. And terrorists would come and creep through the wire and pick up supplies from their, maybe their relatives. They would not admit to having relatives, or those whom we knew had relatives in the jungle said they haven't seen them for years. You see, they wouldn't admit to having seen them at all. But we found on a number of occasions that they were supplying their friends and relatives, and on a number of occasions we could prove it. Sometimes the friends or relatives in the villages could be persuaded to go out and join the terrorists in the jungle, which happened on a number of occasions.
Did you have any success at Bukit Matajam against those 40 guerrillas in the jungle?
Oh yes, yes. I can recall several disposals, I suppose would be the kindest word, that had been that had occurred through the application of military or police jungle forces. You know, you could, your special branch people built up records of the whereabouts of terrorist movements, and also in some cases anticipated movements or future movements, and one had to be terribly cautious about that, because don't forget, in a country where you have to rely upon local people like your police, most of the Malays were fairly safe, but you had Chinese staff who a large number of them were very, very loyal indeed, but you just didn't know what relationship they might have had or what pressure might have been put upon them. I mean, the terrorists were quite vicious. It would be nothing for them to go to a village and, for no reason apart from showing an example, just tie some poor individual to a tree and slash his throat as a reminder that they will be obeyed in the future.
Did you see such bodies?
I never saw one myself, no. But I mean, we had numerous reports of them, the police reports that came through. I had no reason not to.
You were describing the successes you had at Bukit Matajam against the fort.
Yes. We had numbers of bodies that were brought in, some brought in by helicopters. They were usually brought in, and we kept them in, usually. We used to put them into our operations room, and then we would find the nearest usually surrendered terrorist who would be brought in under cover, and we'd be asked to identify them. We kept an order of battle of terrorists of whom we knew, and in time we'd had a fairly complete record, and we even knew when there were changes over from one regiment or one company to another.
Did you know the names of the guerrilla units and the names of the leaders?
We did, though I can recall only one, and that I can tell you about a little later, because I was involved with that one.
In a different area?
Different area, yes. When I moved around, I was in Bukit Matajam. It was whilst I was coming down with that snake, that we were. It was on a subsequent time up the same hill, running down, and I felt a sharp pain in my back, and I thought I might have been hit, but there were terrorists and we were chasing after them, and I put my hand on my back and I couldn't see any blood at all. But by sheer coincidence, it happened to be the result of a Burmese war wound where I was shot at by Japanese, and the bullet went into the liver. And when eventually I got back to the base hospital, they decided not to take it out, as it would be more dangerous to operate than it would be to leave it in. So after a short convalescence, I returned to my regiment and the bullet stayed there. What I hadn't realized, and what we found out later, was that during the course of so much exercise, the bullet had worked its way out of the liver and lodged itself on a kidney and had caused an abscess there. And I had to go into hospital and have the bullet taken out and a piece of kidney taken out where the abscess was. As I was out of action for a little while, I was then told that I would be taken away from Bukit Mentajam because they had to replace me there. And I was moved into Penang and transferred into special branch. And that's the start of my special branch career.
In what capacity did you work in the special branch?
Well, I worked because I had been... I suppose in three areas that were terrorist ridden, I was put in charge of Penang Island terrorism, and my job there was to dispose of the terrorists in the island. In fact, the terrorists in the island were fairly quiet.
Why do you think that was?
I think they were more of the intellectual kind there, and I think possibly they had an outside link with maybe China, which probably caused them not to want to draw attention to themselves.
How did they operate that link? By sea?
Well, that wasn't part of my particular job there. I was just there to catch the ones that showed themselves from time to time. And we had one or two surrenders, and you use the surrenders. If you used a surrender very quickly, as we did on one occasion, within hours we had set up an ambush for another terrorist, and on a signal this terrorist appeared, and we nabbed him.
Captured him alive?
No. He had a gun, and he raised his gun and he was shot.
Was there any special policy to capture the guerrillas alive rather than dead?
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, there was a tremendous campaign for surrendering. And in fact, the government gave, on one occasion, towards the end, gave an amnesty to any terrorists who would surrender. And they sent round slow-flying planes with what we used to call a Magnavox, a loudspeaker on it, and they would also drop hundreds of thousands of leaflets written in Romanized Malay and in Chinese, telling them to surrender and offering them a reward if they did surrender. That caused a little bit of an upset, because your loyal policemen who are constantly fighting against the enemy said, well, what about us? We've been fighting the enemy. You're giving the enemy we're fighting a reward for coming in for fighting us. And it was a difficult situation, but the end result from the government's point of view would have been that if we got some surrenders, and we did get some surrenders, then we would be able to get at the remainder, and then we would be able to make the area white instead of black as it was.
Coming back to Penang, it would seem to me that it would be a very unpromising terrain for guerrillas to operate on a small island.
Well, in one respect it would have been, but the island was not terribly big, and if you really wanted to put to dispose of all of the terrorists that were there, I mean, you could just take all of the soldiery that you had in the whole of Malaya, put it in Penang, and where could they go? Which is why they have, you know, prisons like Devil's Island on islands, because there's nowhere to go once you get off the island. Parkhurst and the Isle of Wight. I mean, if you're really chasing, looking for somebody, Parkhurst is a very difficult place to hide on the Isle of Wight, and Penang. It could have been that they had already, maybe they could have already got a fair bead on the people, the terrorists who were there. There weren't a great number anyway, probably a little more than, say, 20 or 30.
Can you tell me how you went about your special branch work, the kind of methods you used?
Well, within the limitations of security requirements, I would say that information which one already knows, and one can read in the numerous books on intelligence, very simply, you used records that were available to track and spot geographically known terrorists. You form them into groups. They'll be either sections, companies, or regiments. You knew who the leaders were by dint of using, strangely, you know, a lot of people are very careless or vain about photographing themselves. You might use an old school photograph. All right, the person no doubt could be several years older, but at least you've got an outline of what the person does look like. And believe it or not, if you go to China, the first thing a person is going to say is, don't all Chinese look the same? But they don't to Chinese. And I'm sure when Chinese come here, they think, don't all Europeans look the same? But we don't, do we? And they all do look different. You then get photographs. You then, it takes time. If any letters are intercepted, you find details from that, and you collate it all together. You obviously keep records, and you keep them in top secret conditions until eventually you know, or you think you know, where people are. The big thing is having then identified groups and even faces, is to identify where they are at that time.
You said that you used documentary sources. Where did the documents come from?
Well, they might have been intercepted. They might have been by intercepted, I mean, they might be letters that were going out via some rubber tapper who was going out into the jungle with a letter from one communist friend who was not in the jungle, or might even be a communist friend from another area who was in the jungle, and this rubber tapper who was a sympathizer might be going out to hand it over. In the new villages particularly, there were special constables, and everybody, when they went out rubber tapping, they used to carry big 4-gallon tins to put the rubber in, and they would hide letters and on some occasions some food into these containers. I mean, many is the container that has a false bottom, and they would get up to. They were very cunning and very shrewd, as well as being industrious, the Chinese terrorists and their cohorts. what we used to persuade and order the constables to do was to carry a stick and put the stick inside a tin as well as outside to see whether there was a marked difference, and you would find that a very neat line, sometimes a soldering line, would be done around the base of the tin, and we'd take that to pieces and find in there frequently some documents. There were all manners of means of collection of material, and we just patiently pieced it all together until eventually you then used maybe surrendered people, maybe a rubber tapper or a tin mine worker who was prepared or persuaded to talk. Not through, we weren't allowed to use any form of violence on them.
Was that adhered to?
Sorry?
Was that adhered to?
Yes, on the whole, I think it was. There were one or two reported cases of, I mean, not extreme violence, but where people were beaten. And I think there were one or two court cases where, not many, I think two police officers, I think, were just dismissed the service, which meant they lost their job, their pension, and all rights, and were given a...
You've talked about the terror tactics that guerrillas use, but some people seem to think that we use terror tactics as well. Is that true or not?
No. I can honestly say that I was never present, and I never even heard of terror tactics. You would get rumours. I mean, the terrorists were told that... funny rumours that the British would take you up in a helicopter over the sea and drop you into the sea. I mean, these were rumours that were passed around to indicate the brutality of the British. But that was an action that was really quite purposeless. If you had someone whom you suspected was, had information... why drop him in the sea? He's no more use to you. If you had him, you just kept him until eventually he came round. And we had, of course, we had interrogation centres, but it was strictly forbidden that anyone should. And I never heard even of a report in the interrogation centres where people had been mistreated.
Were you personally involved with interrogations?
Only individual interrogations in the areas that I was in, but not in the central interrogation centre, which was near Kuala Lumpur.
What would be the best method to get intelligence from somebody you captured?
Well, you're taught, and you'll read in all the books, there are several methods. There is the hard line and the soft line. Then there is the patient continuous line. It is far better, of course, if you have someone who speaks the same tongue, even though you might speak your version of the same tongue. It is better to have either a Chinese, a Malay, or an Indian interpreter with you, because very few of them were so fluent in English, the terrorists, so fluent in English. There were probably, in all, I shouldn't think.